Welcome to That's Orgasmic, a podcast discussing the orgasmic and not so orgasmic moments of all things sex, relationships, and mental health. I am your host, Emily Duncan, and I'm a sexologist who provides online sex coaching sessions to help you cultivate sexual wellness. Today, I am joined with Emma St. John, who is a psychologist who is committed to building authentic, therapeutic relationships and a space in which her clients feel supported in reaching their goals. Emma flexibly draws upon elements of evidence-based psychological therapies, including cognitive behavioral therapy and schema therapy, to meet the unique and evolving needs of her clients. Emma has also completed specialized training in working with psychosexual difficulties, allowing her to provide psychological interventions to support clients experiencing sexual health challenges. So welcome to That's Orgasmic, Emma.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, I'm so excited to have you on here and all of your expertise. Obviously, you're a psychologist and you've done a lot of work in this space, so I'm super excited to have you on to talk to you. I want to talk about sexual desire today. I think it's a hot topic. Everybody has at least thought about it, I imagine, in their lifetime. Yeah. And there's a lot of conversations around sexual desire. And obviously a lot of individuals struggle with sexual desire in that they especially think it's either too high or too low. They want a higher sexual desire, or they feel like they're not meeting their partner or partner's sexual needs, or like, you know, there's something wrong with them because they don't want sex as much as everybody around them. So I would love to discuss this topic of reconnecting to our sexual desire, as I know that obviously you're currently working in this area. So to begin with, I just want to start with the basics. Are you able to define what sexual desire actually is?
Yes. Look, I can try, because actually, even though it feels like something like that should be basic, defining sexual desire is actually a little bit of a complex concept. So when I talk about sexual desire, I'm referring to a person's interest or motivation to engage in sexual activities, whatever those kinds of activities may be. So for some people, this can look like a clear feeling of lust or like a strong desire or urge to engage in sexual activities. But for other people, this is a much more subtle shift, almost like a subtle shift in mood or motivation. And for other people, it might just kind of be like thinking about their motivations or their reasons for engaging in sex. Some of the time, sexual desire can be spontaneous. So it happens outside of the blue or in response to sexual kind of stimuli. And more often than not, though, sexual desire can be responsive, which means it emerges in response to sexual pleasure or arousal. So it can be happening before, in response to sexual stimulation, but then also in an ideal world, we want to see the kind of desire where when sexual context starts, people want sex to keep going. So it's like in response to, and then it provides like a nice feedback loop where people start to feel pleasure and then they want more. Does that definition make sense? I know it's a bit of a vague concept.
No, absolutely it does. And I love that you brought up the spontaneous versus responsive desire, because I think a lot of people think of desire as just this one thing, that there's no elements to it. And I would have loved to have been taught about that in my sex ed, the responsive and spontaneous, because it is just...
I know, right?
It's so helpful. And once you can finally understand the basic, I guess, building blocks of desire, then you can work out, okay, this is how it's going to work for me.
Yeah. We are like sold and told a narrative that there's like one type of desire that exists, this spontaneous, out of the blue, see someone that you're attracted to or think about sex and just like want to rip your clothes off and start having sex, right? And so if that's the only kind of image that we're given of what desire looks like, if we don't have that, or that changes, or we never had that, then it can leave lots of people kind of turning towards themselves and thinking, well, what's wrong with my desire? What's wrong with my level of desire? So it's important to talk about the different kinds that can exist.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess that kind of leads to my next question, which is, what do you think about society's current perception of sexual desire, and particularly how high, I guess, society thinks that it should be?
Yeah, I mean, we're given so many messages about what sexual desire should look like. And then I think that then flows on to our understanding of how much sex we should be having or how much we should be thinking about sex. And it's really difficult because in order to live up to these societal expectations, it's hard because they're changing all the time. So there is different messages that are given to people who are from different sexes, different genders, different sexual orientations, cultural backgrounds, ages, how long you've been in a relationship. So even if we were just trying to play the game of keeping up with the expectations, like, it would be nearly impossible, right? Like, I don't know. I think, like, maybe if I'm a young woman, healthy, in a healthy relationship, able-bodied, I maybe sold the narrative that I meant to be desiring sex a lot and wanting it a lot. But that same level of sexual desire, if I was all of those things but living in 18th century England, would have been like characterized as like hysteria, and I might have been, you know, called ill or called irresponsible. So it's like even the same level of desire shifts in how we're meant to interpret it over time and context.
Yeah, absolutely. Context plays a massive role. And even just like, as like, as you said, going from country to country, gender to gender, able-bodied to, like, you know, disabled bodies, like, just there's just such a broad range there. And yeah, I know, I've just found, even just within my work, everybody just seems to think that we should be desiring sex more than what we do. Often more than not, like, it's often more that than the other way of being like, I need to desire sex less.
Yes. And do you get asked, like, the how often should I be having sex question a lot in your work?
Yes, absolutely. It's just like people think there's this magic number that is, you know, the right way. And it's just, it's so not the case.
Yeah. And it's like, we do kind of know the numbers, like the population norms, right? Like, people fill out the surveys, we've got like the census data. So we like know the numbers that exist. But I really, when clients and friends of mine push to know the numbers, like, firstly, they can Google it if they really want to know. But secondly, I feel like it decenters the conversation away from the kinds of characteristics of sex that may actually be more important, which for me would be like pleasure and sexual satisfaction. And I would be wanting my clients to move towards like a world in which they could have one night of sensual, amazing, satisfying sex a year rather than 52 nights of pretty average, unsatisfying sex. But on today's kind of success metrics, it feels like we're meant to preference the second option.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very centered around penetrative sex. Like, how often are you having penetrative sex? Not including any of the other little moments throughout the day that are sensual, or like the intimacy and all the other things that are also just so important.
That is such a good point. Yeah. And it's probably very much like cis heteronormative penis and vagina sex that is probably even on the questionnaire tick boxes that we're getting this data from. It just doesn't encompass our new definitions of what sex, sexual experiences should be.
Yeah, I can only imagine people who have filled out surveys who maybe have engaged in like outer play being like, oh, nope, I didn't have sex this week because, you know, I only had a blowjob. Like, I can imagine.
Yeah, or people that have only like had solo sex that week or self-pleasure that week.
Yes, like, oh my God, yes.
Like, where is the tick box for that? Because that can be sometimes people's most satisfying and enjoyable sexual experiences. And that maybe is also a kind of part of the sexual desire that I didn't talk about previously, is that wanting to have sex with yourself, wanting to self-pleasure, connect with your body sexually. That is a whole type of sexual desire in and of itself that's really important to highlight.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you found, at least in your work, that there is a certain like demographic that is most concerned with their sexual desire?
Yeah. Well, I think sexual desire, or sexual desire problems, which I define as people either experiencing a significant drop in their level of sexual desire for a number of months, which they find distressing. So distressing to them for some reason. So if we just think about the drop or the low sexual desire, we know that around 1 in 3 adult women will experience that in their lives. So about a third of the adult female population. So it's pretty significant. And we also think it's the most common sexual arousal concern in like male population as well. So across the board, this is something that is really, really common, but I don't think gets talked about enough, especially with my clients with penises, because there's been biological and medical solutions like Viagra and other kinds of things that can feel a little bit like a stopgap to that sometimes. But actually, those solve an arousal problem, not a desire problem. They give erections, but they don't want people to have sex. So it's kind of like this gap in our market and gap in the understanding of some of the common concerns that people have. So it's 1 in 3 adult women, but actually importantly, it's not 1 in 3 adult women have low desire and are distressed by it. So it's actually 1 in 3 of the 1 in 3 of women meet the criteria for something we call like, you know, female sexual arousal disorder, or having low desire and being really distressed by it. And that gap is important to highlight because it suggests that people can experience low desire, sometimes even lifelong low desire or changes in low desire, and not find it distressing. Be okay with it. And I want to be the last person to come along and say, just because there's diversity of sexual experiences, these parts of the kind of spectrum are pathologized and they have a label and a diagnosis and a disorder. I'm concerned with the kinds of sex lives that people find distressing and want to change. So it's a subset between the subset of people that find it distressing.
I think that's important to differentiate because obviously, you know, there's people who are asexual and people who just, you know, they're completely happy to not desire sex. It's obviously the, I guess, what we're talking about today, the people who find it more distressing and who are wanting to reconnect with that sexual desire.
Exactly right. Yeah. These are people that want to want. They miss wanting. And as you said there, there's also so many context-dependent things like I could be working with partner A who wants to have sex once every 6 months and partner B who wants to have sex once a week. And in that dynamic, partner A is the person that's labeled often as having the desire problem. Whereas if they broke up and partner A started dating partner C and partner C wanted to have sex once a year, all of a sudden partner A would be the higher desire partner and partner C might, you know, say, come and see me and say, I've got the low desire problem. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these things we're talking about differentials between partners or different relationship structures and discrepancies that generate distress. But on top of the kind of differential that can create distress, the kinds of people that I see that find low desire most distressing are the people who have high expectations around what their sex drive should look like. So people that have really been told the narrative that we were talking about, that we should be having sex X amount of times. Understandably, when they compare their own experiences to that, people can turn towards themselves and think that there's something wrong with them, which can be distressing. Other kinds of people would be if they've got a history or kind of co-occurring depression or anxiety at the same time. Generally, the longer that the low desire has been going on for, people find more distressing. If in addition to the low desire, they're experiencing their sexual contact as not pleasurable, so that the sex that they're having, if they're having it, kind of sucks. And then finally, often one of the most distressing things is when people can't like point at a specific thing in their environment and say, like, that's what's causing my low desire. So many people would experience low desire after like a really, really big stressful life event, like you take on a big project at work, you have an experience of drop in desire. But if that person is able to say like, okay, my desire has dropped significantly, but I'm pretty sure it's tied to this specific context, I'm sure it'll go away, that's generally less distressing than people who feel like their drop in desire has come out of nowhere, because that's when they start to worry, well, what if it never changes?
No, absolutely. And I guess that when we haven't been taught about it and then also being given the resources to be able to work through that, or even just identify what's going on in your own life and have that awareness of how that's impacting your desire, like obviously that's going to be distressing for people. And it leads, I guess, to the next question, which is we've touched on, I guess, throughout this whole conversation so far, is what impacts our sexual desire?
Almost everything.
I was going to say everything.
Yeah. So if we break it down into different factors, we might have like physical factors. So some of these things might be like fluctuations in hormone levels. So like during pregnancy or postpartum or perimenopause, menopause, those can significantly shift our levels of desire. Certain medications, even antidepressant medications, especially SSRIs, hormonal contraceptives, they can also have a pretty significant shift in people's level of desire. But I think, interestingly, maybe specific to people who are transgender or are kind of gender non-binary and pursuing gender-affirming treatments that kind of help their biological body match up with their gender identity, they may find really wonderful results of things like hormone replacement therapy or things like bottom surgery in terms of helping ease their dysphoria, feel more comfortable in their body. But those things can also have pretty significant effects on the sexual response cycle. So giving someone testosterone often increases someone's level of sexual desire, but blocking testosterone and adding estrogen tends to dampen or subside that level of sexual arousal. So we have things like those medications that can be really life-saving, and other kinds of treatment like antidepressants or hormonal contraceptions that are pretty necessary. But you're walking this kind of like, it's a bit of a double-edged sword where while it may be helping with one thing, it's got this unfortunate side effect of dampening desire.
Definitely. And I feel like especially things like hormonal contraception, it's not something that's talked about, especially when you're given that script, especially if you're a teenager, for instance, and you've been given that script. It's not even a conversation. It's not even brought up that how that could even impact your sexual desire.
Exactly right. And like, I know for a fact that I've worked with clients who are seeing really good like results or from say like an SSRI medication for their mood, but they stop because 6 months down the track, they haven't had an orgasm since they started, or they haven't been able to maintain an erection since they started. And then I just don't know if people are kind of reporting back to their GPs or their care providers the extent to which the medications are impacting on their sexual functioning. And so then they stop taking the medication because it's a wonderful thing. They're trying to prioritize their sexual well-being. But it does kind of give me, you know, a moment to pause and think about, gosh, I wish there was medications that could do all the good stuff without all these side effects.
I know. It'd be amazing to have a world where we could just have, you know, medications that do their job and that's it. They don't leave any side effects, affect anything else.
Exactly. Maybe we'll live to see the day, but not today. In addition to the kind of physical things, we've got maybe some relational dynamics that can affect desire as well. So whether or not kind of someone's in a new stage of their relationship where there's lots of that hot and heavy spontaneous desire, or if someone's been together for 20 years, so it's more of a, you know, you've got to stoke the ember a little bit to have that spark again. Or if there's relationship conflict or lack of communication or lack of emotional intimacy, all those things can have flow-on effects to just how much people are experiencing pleasurable physical contact with each other, which we know affects someone's level of sexual desire as well. And then as a psychologist, I'd be remiss to kind of not talk about the psychological aspects of desire. I mean, I think depression and anxiety have significant flow-on effects to desire. Like, one of the core diagnostic characteristics of major depressive disorder is this thing called anhedonia, which is a fancy way of saying getting bored or losing interest in the things that we used to like or find pleasure in. And sex is kind of one of the major things that can be affected by that. So that's why, in addition to working with me and sexologists, I encourage all my clients to get like a physical workup done. And if kind of we're feeling like there are some markers that there could be some mood concerns or anxiety concerns, to also go see a mental health professional or someone who's got the experience of walking that line between sexology and psychology, to see which parts of this might be like purely sexological and which parts of this may be better explained for by like the consequence of a mental health concern.
Definitely. And I think that's when like a multidisciplinary approach is so important, because you know, you can't just I don't want to use the word fix, but you can't just, I guess, address one thing necessarily with one provider and expect it to address everything. Like, everything is so complicated, and especially when you look at certain things, say, like, I don't know, vaginismus. We've mm-hmm. got the psychological side, the physical side, and there's so much where you can go from the doctor, the physio, to the psychologist, to the sexologist. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just so important to, I guess, have that holistic approach so that we are addressing everything and being able to get the best outcome possible.
I completely agree. Yeah. And it's difficult, right? I'm sure in your experience as a sexologist, we're often one of the last care providers that people have come to on that journey. Mm-hmm. They'll start at mm-hmm. a GP, they might go to their gyno or their, you know, male sexual health clinician, and then they might see a PT, then they might see a psychiatrist or see a counselor before all the way they kind of come to us at the end. And I think it would look different if there was a way that we could all work together as a circle, because unfortunately there just really isn't that many public health teams where there can be that multidisciplinary team around sexual functioning, at least in Australia.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I've found that with clients, it's often like they'll write to me like, this is my last resort. And it's like, it shouldn't be the last resort. This should be something that people are aware of and have access to and that doctors are referring to. And it's, you know, it's not this last thing where they just feel like they've got no hope left. And if this doesn't work, well, then, you know, they're forever going to have to live like this.
Yeah, yeah. And if we're thinking that kind of one of the things that contributes to low desire, or one of the things that keeps low desire going, is some of those catastrophic thoughts about what this means for yourself and your relationship, then the process by which people have to seek help enforces that sense of, this is going to be so hard to fix, this is going to be so expensive to fix, there must be something really wrong with me if this is my seventh doctor. So even, you know, just the way that people have seeked care in the past is accidentally reinforcing some of these beliefs, which make it worse. It's so frustrating. Yeah.
Absolutely. I obviously want to touch on how to begin to reconnect to our sexual desire. And obviously that is a massive question. but I guess, yeah, like as a starting point, what would you recommend for us if we're wanting to reconnect to our desire?
Yeah. I think the most important thing that comes to mind at the start with is to think about chronic stress. So the amount that we have to hold and the amount that is on our cognitive load day to day. So in addition to all those factors I talked about before, one of the most common things I hear is that while people are having sex, or maybe they're getting ready for bed and thinking it could happen that night, a part of their mind might be thinking about sex, but like 80% of it might be thinking about what to put in the kids' lunchboxes tomorrow, or like a big work meeting, or just like how tired we all are. So thinking about how much chronic stress we're all under and doing all the things that we know that we should be doing, exercise, sleeping well, managing our stress in the best ways that we can, not taking on too much where possible, is one of those unglamorous but pretty helpful ways to start melting, I guess, some of the layers around the things that keep sexual desire problems going. Another thing that could be really helpful is to think about maybe even doing like some journaling around what are the kind of common anxieties or worries that pop up before sex, or when you're just thinking about sex, if sex isn't something that's happening for you at the moment, and to see whether or not there are any kind of specific trends or patterns that you've noticed have evolved or changed over time. And then if you feel like there are some that are kind of very much focused on past traumatic sexual experiences or things related to low self-esteem or low self-worth or body image, that would be a time that I think it would be really helpful to bring in some outside professional support, because mm-hmm. those things can be really hard to walk through alone and to carry the burden on their own. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, obviously looking at your lifestyle to start with and the stress, because it's not often you sit and you think about, okay, how is everything in my life actually impacting me? And then obviously, how is that going to impact your sexual desire? Because, you know, if you've got stuff with work and then you've got kids and you've got to cook and you clean, the last thing you want to do when you go to bed and you know, you want your 8 hours of sleep is to then, you know, be sexual. So I think that obviously is like, is such a great starting point. I guess for those who, do you think it's like, once obviously you could identify, okay, maybe I'm stressed, I'm anxious, I'm having these thoughts around sex, that, you know, now that even just, you know, anxious thoughts about sex, like, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, I've got such a low desire, I'm not going to be able to get an erection, or I'm not going to be able to orgasm, and like, you know, focusing on all of these other things because you're already stressed and now you're stressing about the sex. I guess, do you have any advice? Obviously, you said journaling to start with to unpack that. Do you have any, I guess, further steps for, I guess, maybe getting back into our bodies and our desire?
Yes, definitely. So I can't really give any specific advice on a platform like this, you know, obvious disclaimer, go seek registered health professionals. But what I would suggest is that we can use some of the skills that mindfulness practices have taught us about how to manage stress, how to manage anxious thoughts, how to manage depressive thoughts, and use those as a skill to translate into how to manage sexually anxious thoughts, right? So mindfulness, you know, which is paying attention to the present moment, curiously, non-judgmentally, on purpose, is a practice that many, you know, traditions in the East have been using for thousands and thousands of years. And westernized kind of medicine has only really secularized them and made them popular in the last 100 years or so. But we are seeing really, really significant, longstanding, reliable results that mindfulness practices have a really beautiful effect on reducing stress and anxiety, lifting mood, and that also has a really direct causal flow-on effect with increasing sexual desire. So I would encourage listeners to actually not start with building in a mindfulness practice around their sexual contact, but to actually just start in their day-to-day. So maybe that's having a look at some of the mindfulness apps, you know, that are available online, or joining a mindfulness-based stress reduction course or a meditation course at a local community center, and try and see if they can integrate those practices in their day-to-day life. So I run a course where we try and integrate mindfulness into bringing out and reconnecting to sexual desire. But actually, for the first 4 weeks of an 8-week course, we don't really do any mindfulness in partnered sex or about sexual activity. It's just about strengthening the muscle of paying attention to sexual arousal. Because more often than not, I actually think there is levels of sexual desire and arousal that are there. But these chronic, anxious, intrusive thoughts, or the constant to-do list that we have, gets in the way of us reconnecting to that. So if we can start to strengthen the muscle of noticing, and then shifting our attention back to pleasure and arousal in our body, then we tend to see we create that nice feedback loop where all of a sudden sexual experiences start to become pleasurable again. And then we start to crave what we find pleasurable. So that would be some of my suggestions, to not particularly start with sex, to start in life and then apply those same skills to sexual experiences.
Yeah, and I love that. I think because when you're already anxious potentially about sex or about your desire, trying to then try something new within that space, and then obviously you're going to have thoughts of, oh my God, like I can't keep my mind clear. I can't keep my focus on that. I keep thinking about this. I'm doing it wrong. Because obviously when it comes to meditation, so many people when they first start think they're doing a bad job because they're thinking about other things and they can't keep this focus on their breath or whatever they're trying to focus on. So obviously starting with that outside of the bedroom to get, you know, it's like, it's almost like going to the gym. It's something you've just got to incorporate to strengthen that muscle. And it's such a beneficial thing to do anyway, because it's going to impact positively, not just on your sex life, but most likely have a flow-on effect in all different areas, because it's there's so much research out there to show how like impactful mindfulness is on so many different things.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason we call it a practice, right? It's something that we have to practice every day. And so if, you know, the 20 minutes sitting down and going full monk doesn't appeal to you, then I get clients to integrate just moments of mindfulness into their day. So that's sitting down and eating a meal with no podcast, no Netflix, no work, just tuning into the sensations of eating. It might be the next time that you're in a workout class, pause your music for a moment and just tune in to the kinds of sensations of shifting in your muscles. You can do things like mindful body scans, where you shift your attention and your focus to different areas of your body. My one kind of qualm with mindfulness scans, like body scans that are on the internet, is that they will direct people to pay attention to every single part of their body except for the genitals. Like, the genitals are like such an ignored part of body scans, right?
Oh my, I've never thought of that. I've done so many like meditations. I always use the Headspace app, but they always brush over the genitals. I think there's only been maybe one or two that I've done, but they've been specifically for reconnecting to your like desire. All the others just brush over it.
Exactly right. They go like thigh, buttocks, stomach. They'll go everywhere but mentioning,
Yes. Yeah.
So what I would suggest, if you're using these, you know, wonderful free apps or YouTube things, insert your own part of the meditation where you focus directly on noticing sensations in your genitals. Because if you think about it, often the only times in our day that we may notice a sensation in our genitals is like, I don't know, friction while getting dressed, wiping while going to the bathroom, pain if you experience pain, and maybe that's it, right? If we're not experiencing a level of sexual arousal. And so our brain isn't tuned to pay attention and have awareness to that part of the body. And if we're kind of talking about someone with a vulva, where there isn't as many physically or visually obvious signs of arousal as there is with someone with a penis, then it's even more important for people with vulvas to pay attention to the less subtle but no less pleasurable ways that our bodies ignite to tell us that we're aroused.
Definitely. And I think there's definitely, I guess, a gap in that space where obviously a penis owner has been taught that if they look down and they've got an erect penis, I'm aroused. Whereas for vulva owners, it's just like, you know, maybe if you're wet, but then obviously there's non-coordinates, so lubrication doesn't actually mean that you're aroused. So it can be so tricky to actually know, like, how do I know if I'm aroused? And if you've never spent that time to really sit with yourself and, you know, do body scans or look in the mirror and see what it looks like when your genitals are aroused, it's really difficult to know that.
Yeah, it is so difficult. And that's why we know that with penis overs, there's a reduced amount of genital non-concordance. So generally when, and this is, you know, there's exceptions to this rule, but if someone has an erection, they're viewing sexually relevant stimuli, they want to have sex, they can kind of look at their erection and feel their erection and be like, cool, I am turned on. So with their objective measures of sexual arousal, their penis matches their subjective level of mental arousal, the amount that they would subjectively rate that they felt turned on. They often go side by side. With vulva owners, there can be a lot more genital non-concordance. Their vulva, their kind of level of lubrication, their level of erectile tissue swelling and throbbing can actually be pretty significant before someone will subjectively recognize that they are turned on. What mindfulness exercises have been shown to do is reduce the level of non-concordance. So we're able to actually notice when our body is giving us those same signs. And when our level of sexual arousal may have been objectively suppressed because some of those physical factors that we talked about, it's even more important that we cultivate an awareness of the arousal and the desire that remains.
Yes, definitely. What do you think about, I guess, context and sexual desire? Because I know for some people, as soon as you tell them, all right, sex is off the table, you know, you're not having sex this week or for 2 weeks, all of a sudden there's this sexual desire and they, you know, they're wanting to have sex because mm-hmm. it's, you know, that context has changed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it points so much to how much of a mood killer obligation to have sex is, mm-hmm. right? Or how much of, you know, it can hit people's brakes to feel like they have to have sex. So, yeah, often, you know, as in sex therapy, we will ban sex for periods of time to help relieve people of those expectations that they have to be doing it for certain amounts of time or at different times, and to get people to engage in ways that feel like they're aiming for sensuality and connection rather than explicit sexuality. So, yeah, context is really important. Having people be free to enjoy the level of sexual stimulation that they want, rather than feeling like they've got to go towards a very goal-orientated reason for having sex. Even the sexual triggers that people find that elicit desire for them can change over time. Like a classic example is like a young like woman with breasts may find nipple stimulation to be highly pleasurable in their early 20s. And then say they go on to have children, they're breastfed, and then their partner tries to do that same exact stimulation to them. But all of a sudden, the context around what that means has shifted pretty considerably. And that could be confusing for the partner. They're like, you liked this when you were 25. And that can be confusing to them because they're like, I thought I was meant to like this. So we need to also be flexible with that. The sexual triggers that we're using to turn us on can shift and change over time. And that's not a failure of us. That's just a shift in context.
Mm-hmm. And it shows the importance of constantly checking in with yourself and what you're finding arousing and how it's feeling, and with your partner. Because obviously the way you have sex in that first year with your partner is not going to be the same 50 years later or any type. Like, it can change so often. So I think obviously communication, I mention it literally in every single podcast episode, but I think it's also really important, because then if you're openly communicating, then also we'll link back to sexual desire, because obviously there's going to be times throughout our life when our desire goes up and down.
Oh, yes.
And yeah, obviously if how we're enjoying sex is changing, if all of a sudden it's, you know, we're not enjoying things we were before, obviously your desire is not going to be the same if your partner or partners keep trying to have sex in the same way that they think is,
yeah,
it's pleasuring you.
Exactly right. The amount that people are enjoying sex, the amount that they rate that they're satisfied, significantly affects how much they will desire it in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, when was the last time that you ever craved food that you didn't like, right? Like we
never.
Only crave the things that we like, right?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
I'm not on Uber Eats looking for things that the last time I had I hated. So mm-hmm. it's important for us to think about, sometimes low sexual desire is a problem. Sometimes low desire might be evidence of like good judgment. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not meant to like things if they're not pleasurable. So
yeah.
Sometimes we got to think about actually the sexual content itself. What can we do to improve that? Then let's mm-hmm. see what happens with desire.
I think that's a great way for people to look at it too, is being like, okay, let me use this as a moment to reflect on how I'm having sex at the moment. Is this what I actually want it to look like? And am I enjoying that? It doesn't necessarily mean that there's a, you know, an issue or something like, you know, going on, a problem with them.
Exactly.
Do you have, I guess, any other tips that you think is important to touch on when it comes to reconnecting to sexual desire?
I think maybe a nice exercise that people could try to kind of walk the line between mindfulness outside of sexual contact and then bringing it in is an exercise that we do, is that we'll get participants to use a sexual aid of some kind. So, for example, reading some erotica or using a vibrator or something else like that for around 2 to 3 minutes, and then stop and then lie down and just notice what is happening in your body. use that as like the body scan exercise where you are shifting your attention to every single different part of the body, feeling really neutral, but curious and observant over what is happening. There may be signs that your body is turned on that you never even recognized as being part of your sexual response cycle. People might notice that their breath changes or they feel flushed or their heart starts kind of beating in a different way. And all of those things might have been lost if the ways that we're looking for, am I aroused or not, are kind of contained to what's in our pants, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe that's something you can try to cue into the signs of arousal that are still there. They just need, they're kind of waiting to be reconnected to and waiting to be observed in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Would you recommend, obviously you do your 2 or 3 minutes, do a body scan. Would you recommend then going back, doing another few minutes body scan, or is it like a once off, just so the listeners, I guess, know how to engage with it?
Yeah. I would say you could probably do multiple rounds, right? Mm-hmm. But the goal isn't that you get yourself to orgasm or you get yourself to ejaculation. The goal is that you notice your signs of arousal. If you're doing like a comprehensive body scan, we'd be saying it might take, you know, 20 to 40 minutes to really scan through the body. So it would be interesting to see what it would be like if you tried to do that once a day, every day for 7 days. How much could you notice about how much your body comes alive in response to sexual stimuli that you didn't know at the start? And then you could maybe flip it. Do a body scan for 20 minutes and then try and do some kind of partnered sex with your partner or some stimulation with yourself. Notice how your body goes from neutral to being aroused. And to see and witness every different stage of that sexual response cycle for yourself. It's going to be different for everyone. It's going to be different every day to get curious about what it's like for you.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's definitely a great exercise that honestly I feel like everybody should do just to get in tune with their bodies. Because it's obviously something we're not taught to do. And regardless of whether you're having difficulties or not, I think it's such a just a great skill to have and, you know, something really important for us to touch on. Is there anything else within this topic that you think you'd like to touch on?
I think if people are interested in learning more about how mindfulness can be integrated, then they should really follow the work of a wonderful researcher and clinician called Laurie Brodo. She is the Better Sex Through Mindfulness Pioneer. That's the name of her book. That's the name of like her life's purpose. And it is truly wonderful, the work that she has done. So her book, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, and then the workbook that's come out recently is an incredible resource. And it has all the step-by-step kind of instructions for the exercises that I just talked about. And it is on her work and her group program that she's conducted clinical trials on a number of different client populations that I feel really lucky to be able to help clients with now. So if you like what you've heard today, I think it would be a really nice next step.
And now obviously you are running your own program, so I'd love to hear a bit about that, especially if there's, I don't know if you still have spots available, but if there's anybody listening who would be interested in participating, are you able to just tell us a bit about it and the participants you're looking for?
Yes, of course. So it is a 8-week mindfulness-based cognitive behavior therapy program for women who are struggling with low desire. So this is not people who are okay with their level of sexual desire. It's people who have noticed a significant shift or have always had low desire and are wanting to want again, are wanting to feel sexually connected again. And so I work with adults of all genders, sexualities, cultural backgrounds. But this group in particular is for people who identify as women, and with a very expansive definition of what that means, including cis women, trans women, non-binary femme folk, people who have received some kind of gender-affirming interventions, and none at all. If you identify as a woman, you're an adult, and you have low desire, and you want to change that, you are welcome. It goes for 8 weeks, and we follow the mindfulness-based cognitive behavior therapy program that's been clinically evaluated to be really, really effective for increasing relationship satisfaction, sexual satisfaction, and reducing anxiety and rumination about sex. So it is predominantly based on the work of Laurie Brodo, but I'm really excited to bring it to the practice where I work, which is called King Street Psychology Clinic, which has a particular focus on working with gender diverse folk. So it's welcoming for all kinds of genital structures and gender identities, because I really do believe that we are more similar than we are separate. So I'm hoping it's a welcoming and affirming space for everyone. So to find out more about the group, you can go to King Street Psychology. We'll have rolling intakes throughout the year, so you can just register your interest. And if a group doesn't sound like you, or you don't have 8 weeks to commit, or you're not in Sydney, you can reach out to me at emmasinjin.com.au and see the practices I work out, get some individual sessions as well.
Yeah, amazing. And I'll link all of the like websites, everything in the show notes so everybody can easily access that. Now, wonderful. The question I ask everybody is, what is something that is orgasmic to you?
Yes, okay. I've been thinking about this because I was like, what even does it mean to be orgasmic? And for me, you know, I approach things with this mindfulness lens in which I think it means I'm grounded in the body, I'm in the present moment, and like what's more orgasmic than feeling just like completely swept away in the senses. Mm-hmm. So I think for me that would be like moments where I feel really turned like alive by my senses. So like, I don't know, biting into like a piece of fruit that's just like perfect, or listening to music and it's so beautiful, and then like you hear the swell of the chorus, and then you get like goosebumps on your body, things like that, where it's like, I don't know, sometimes I feel like I live so much of my mind in my of my day in my mind, and then I remember I have a body. So that feels pretty orgasmic to me. Yeah,
I love that. It just made me think of like, you know, when you step outside and it's just like crisp fresh air and you breathe it in, and it just reminds you like, I'm a human. You know, I'm alive on this world.
Exactly. There is more to me than emails and notifications and work to be done. Exactly right.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge. It's been super insightful, and I know this is something that's going to resonate with a lot of people, and I'm glad that we were able to, I guess, get them started on a journey of reconnecting with their sexual desire. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
As always, Shaggers, please reach out with any comments, questions, or stories, either through my Instagram at That's Orgasmic or my email at emilyduncan@thatsorgasmic.com. Please subscribe whatever platform you still listen to this podcast and leave a review, as I'd love to know what you're thinking. So thank you, Shaggers, and I'll see you next time.